Help me welcome our speaker tonight, Joe from Roosevelt 12 and 12 in York.
My name is Joe Lear. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 26, 1991. Kind of like in a courtroom, got the bright lights on you. I tell you my sobriety date because there was a time I didn't have a sobriety date, and I like to do a lot of talking in AA. And if I would have given you my sobriety date back then, you would have known exactly how long to listen to me. You know, it's always amazing, you know, somebody like me who is new would come in and start sharing and unload my litany of problems for the day or the week. And after I'd get done sharing, people would clap their hands and say, "Thanks for sharing, Joe. Keep coming back." And after I got a sponsor, I tried that one time, and my sponsor told me, "Why don't you sit down, shut up, and listen? We don't want what you got." You know, and that's really what I needed to hear, because I thought I knew something when I got to AA. I remember, I was at a meeting, and I was probably maybe about a couple of months sober, and my sponsor introduced me to a guy, and the guy said, "Oh, Tom, that's your new guy." I said, "Oh, no, I'm not new. I've been here for like 2 months. You know, like I've been here for a long time or something." And you know, I don't know what the hardest thing anybody in this room has to do. You know, I guess if we passed around a basket and said, "Write down the most difficult thing you're going to have to do when you get to AA," and it would probably be steps 4 and 5, and steps 8 and 9. The basket would be full. But my experience has been the hardest thing I've had to do since I've been here was to finally get to that place where I had no other choice but to walk up to another man and say, "Would you please help me?" And I'm not talking about the kind of help before you get ready to walk into a courtroom. I think most of us, or a lot of us in this room, should know how to ask for that kind of help. They even give us a name for it. It's called plea bargaining. Or the kind of help before she's getting ready to throw you out again, or he, whichever the case may be. We call that begging and pleading. And if you're anything like me, as all that really means is, "I'm sorry until next time." The home group I belong to is the Roosevelt 12 and 12 group. It meets on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock down in beautiful, right outside downtown York, Pennsylvania. And in my mind, it's one of the best groups that I've ever had the opportunity to belong to. I don't want to say it's the best group in York, PA, or Quakerstown, PA, or anything like that. A good friend of mine, she kind of corrected me on that. I was running around saying that in AA. And she said, "If you don't think your home group is the best home group, please don't come to ours and screw it up. Just stay there and make it the best group you possibly can." Because, you know, if you're like me, we want to go somewhere and try to fix things and change things. And when we first started Roosevelt 12 and 12, York wasn't having such a good name in AA back at that time. And we had started working in churches local in town, and we had to continue to work our way out until we found a church that would have us. And, you know, what I'm getting at is a lot of times we can create problems for Alcoholics Anonymous and not even realize that that's what we're doing, because there's a lot of people who are looking at us. And the good news is our church that we have our meeting at, they come up to us about every couple of months and they thank us for bringing a meeting in there. They're very grateful for having Alcoholics Anonymous there. And there was a time that there was a lot of groups in our area that they were about ready to be kicked out of their meeting halls. Because one of the things, just a simple thing, like smoking, you know? And I mean, how difficult is it to not smoke at the door? But we couldn't listen to something as simple as that. Or, you know, a lot of things. And I go back to, what is the main problem of the alcoholic? At least for me, the main problem isn't drinking. Drinking's really what held me together long enough to keep me from committing suicide to get here. The main problem, at least for this alcoholic, started like around the third or fourth grade. You remember report card day? Everybody gets all their report cards and they're passing them out, and the teacher hands me my report card, and mine's the only one that's sealed shut. And the teacher says, "You need to carry this home to Mom and Dad." And I carried it home to Mom and Dad, and they opened it up and they had that look of disappointment. One that was going to follow me for a long time. And it wasn't the grades that were the problem. It was the little notes at the top that the teacher writes. And the first note that the teacher wrote said, "Your son cannot seem to follow simple directions. And I think to myself, as I look back, that's really the main problem of the alcoholic. We just can't seem to follow simple directions. We come here and, you know, I started coming to AA back in 1989, and I would have told you that AA didn't work. And the truth is I could not seem to follow simple directions. You know, in 1989, when I first came to AA, I was married. I had a good job building a house out in Carroll County, Maryland, and a wife, two kids. You know, on the outside, everything looked good. And everybody thought I had a problem with drinking except me. You know, and my wife said to me, she said to me, if you keep drinking, this marriage is over. And I remember thinking, I didn't say this to her, I remember thinking to myself, how will she ever survive without me? Right? I'm here to tell you she had my replacement 6 months before I was gone. You know, they seem to do okay without us. And the judge said to me, Mr. Lear, if you keep drinking, you're going to jail for a long time. And my first thought, like I said, I got this alcoholic mind. And in my mind, I'm thinking, how is the judge going to find out if I'm drinking? I mean, it's not like I'm going to be sitting at the bar getting drunk and think, oh, I better call Your Honor and let him know that I've been drinking again tonight. And then if you've been coming around AA for a little while, little voices begin to talk to you. And this little voice said to me, Joe, the judge is going to find out you're drinking the same way he did this time. Because I don't know about you guys, I'm not really good with drinking and not creating problems. You know, one of my times drinking, have you ever got so drunk you couldn't find the exit to the parking lot? I mean, that's the kind of drinking I like to do. I know there was one when I got there, but I could not seem to find it when I was leaving. And so I decided to make my own path, and I just hop up over the curb, and there's one of your finest sitting there waiting for me. I almost hit him. You know, it's like I didn't really have to work a lot to get caught, you know? He was just right there waiting for me. And I had the mind to say that, you know, they're following me. They're out to get me, you know? Like, they don't have anything better to do in life but to sit around waiting for drunks like me, you know? And, you know, it's ironic, by the time we get to AA, all of the garbage that's in this mind, you know? And but I love to drink. It's obvious I love to drink than I love my first wife. You know, and I love to drink more than I actually love my kids. That's hard to say. I mean, if you'd asked me that question, I would have told you no. But the truth is, I love to drink more than I love my kids. I love to drink more than I love my freedom. Because for me, alcohol was freedom. And the best way I can describe it, I don't think that I was an instant alcoholic or... I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. I really don't know. I know that somewhere along through my drinking, I crossed the line that I wasn't going to be able to drink and stop drinking of my own free will anymore. But I think that started when I began to drink early on. I was about 13 years old when I had my first drink. Actually, my brother and I, we were only 9 and 11. Neither one of us had been drinking yet. And we used to get shot glasses in Coca-Cola, and we used to fill the shot glasses up and knock back about 3 or 4 of them, and then beat the hell out of each other. You know, it's what I didn't realize that was going to become true later on. My brother died from alcoholism at the age of 29. He was 2 years older than me. You know, and I think most of us in this room have at least one or two people that we're close to who have died from this. And I'm here to tell you that that's just not enough to keep us sober or get us sober. But I was about 13 years old when I started drinking, and I was at a banquet with my parents, and it was a planned drunk. I mean, I planned I was going to get drunk this night. We were at a banquet room probably about the size of this, and it was for Show and Horses. It was a banquet, and I knew most of the people that were going to be there. And in my opinion, my little 13-year-old opinion of those people was they're a very miserable lot. You know, they just seemed gloomy and down and miserable and depressed. But this night, all these people were drinking and dancing and laughing and just having the grandest old time you ever seen. And there was this one guy who was Bill, and he kept saying, you know, you can dance with my wife, you know, just bring her back when you're done. And he had a couple of more drinks. Oh, hell, go ahead and take her home with you. And my little 13-year-old ears perked up. I thought a little wife swapping going on there. You know, I kind of like that idea, you know. And I remember I seen a little girl sitting back in the corner. She was about 13, and all I wanted to do was ask her to dance and get out there and have a good time. But I couldn't seem to get out of my chair. So as what I did that night is I started going around to all the tables. I have absolutely no idea what I drank that night. But somewhere around the third or fourth drink, something happened to me. And as what happened is, after about the third or fourth drink, I look back there again, and it's like somebody took that 13-year-old girl out of the room and brought this 18-year-old model in, and I intuitively knew that she wanted me. You ever get that feeling? You know that they want you. And I made my way to the back of the room. I asked her to dance, and we got out there. We won a dance contest that night. I thought we invented dirty dancing at the age of 13. I mean, I got in a lot of trouble. I was trying to take her clothes off out on the dance floor. Just fun stuff, right? And, I mean, we won a dance contest that night. I mean, it was just the greatest evening of my life. Now, the truth is, I got in a lot of trouble. I got carried home. You remember the next day after a good night of drinking? And your parents, they can't wait to maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon to have a talk about your drinking. It's got to be 7 a.m. the next morning. Do you remember 7 a.m. the next morning after that good night of drinking? Everything hurts. And I guess my parents were trying to teach me some kind of lesson, because they put me in bed in what I was wearing the night before, and it was what I was wearing the night before. Everybody at that banquet was dressed in Western outfits, boots, and just, I mean, it was a Western get-up. And I was the only one that showed up kind of looking like John Travolta. Black slacks, heels about that high. I have no idea what that was about. A white silk shirt with puffy sleeves. I felt out of place while I was there. But they sat me in a chair that morning, and I kind of took my inventory for the first time. And I looked down, and I realized that somebody had thrown up all over me. You know, that white silk shirt was kind of nasty. And I looked down a little further, and I realized somebody had peed my pants too. You know, I don't know what kind of a lesson I was supposed to learn from that, but I can be honest with you that bedwetting saved my life a lot. I did a lot of bedwetting. I mean, I did so much bedwetting that when I got married, my wife had to go to the doctors for her bladder that she thought it was her. Well, I led her to believe that it was her anyway, you know, and I guess I would just roll over and pee on her and then turn back over and be a big wet spot where she was, you know, and but I used to like to smoke and drink too, so it's really hard to burn a saturated bed. So, but my parents, the very first words out of their mouth that morning was, my mother had never read the big book of AA, but the very first thing she said to me is, you're like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde when you drink. Something happens to you when you drink. You change when you drink. Your personality, the way you act, the way you talk, the way you treat people, just at your everything about you changes. And you shouldn't drink. You have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And I'm a little 13-year-old kid. I'm hungover. My pants are everything, just miserable. And I'm not ready to argue that morning. I said to my parents, Mom and Dad, you're right. I probably shouldn't drink. But deep down inside where the alcoholic lives, if you're anything like me, I didn't say this to them, but I said it to my, I said, no shit, I change when I drink. I like the change that happens to me when I drink. Don't drink? Man, I can't wait to do this again. Bedwetting and throwing up is a small price to pay for what happened to me the night before. Something happened to me the night before. And pretty much you can characterize my whole drinking history or story or whatever you want to call it as trying to get back to 13, to where I was free. I didn't care what these people thought of me. I just let loose and I was free for the first time. And I tried to recapture that over and over and over again. And for a long time, I captured somewhat that or something along the lines of it. And I had a lot of fun drinking. You know, I didn't go to jail the first time I drank. I probably should have, you know, the statutory rape or something, you know, because of the things I was doing. But man, I just loved to drink. And if drinking was still doing for me what it did back then and AA wasn't working, I can assure you I still wouldn't be here. I don't know exactly when I had my next drink, but I can assure you that it wasn't a very long period after that. I've never had a problem getting a drink. You know, I hear some people say, you know, I was 13 or 14, I couldn't get booze anytime I want. I'd never had a problem. We had a riding stable, and we had people who would come in and go riding, and you know, I became a little entrepreneur at that age. You know, I never had a problem getting a drink. You know, there was this one, two guys that used to come to our stable on a regular basis, and I'm not going to tell you what they did for a living. I'll try to describe them to you a little bit. And they were black gentlemen. They had this big Cadillac, They had feathers coming out of their hat. And they had the most beautiful women you had ever seen. And they became my new heroes. And they would bring me booze all the time. And they could ride for as long as they could take the horses home. I didn't care. You know? But I never had a problem. I used to get drunk all the time. My brother and I got drunk. We break things, you know, just fun stuff. But somewhere along the line, I don't know when it happened or when I crossed that line. I used to say it happened when I got married, that it was her fault. I mean, she never had a problem. She used to love to buy me booze. That's why I married her, right? That's a good reason to get married, isn't it? I mean, we were kids growing up. We knew each other as kids. Her parents owned a riding stable and a sale barn up in Westminster, and we used to go up there with little kids, and she'd be down in the ring leading the horse around. I'd spit on her, you know, maybe throw a cup of coffee on her, and if I was on a good night, I'd grab some horse crap and throw it at her. You know, I thought I didn't like her. A good friend of mine, he says, "Don't you know what that was, Joe?" He said, "That's foreplay, because you guys got married later." And it wasn't a problem. My drinking wasn't a problem to her until after we got married. We get married, and the very first thing that happened was, "You drink too much. You need to do something about your drinking." I only had 2 DWIs at that time, so I figured it really wasn't a big problem, right? And I guess she was getting tired of, you know, the way things were going about my drinking, you know, not being able to show up or saying I was going to be there. Or just, I don't know how you were, but I'd get about 3 drinks in me and I'd get an idea and I would disappear for a period of time. I'd start thinking about Florida and I'd start drinking and I'd end up there, you know. And I don't remember how I got there. Another time I was that drunk, my wife was getting on me about my drinking. So I started following her around. I was sober, right? You follow somebody around long enough and you nag them long enough that she finally had enough of me. She says, "Why don't you just go out and get drunk?" Man, that was my ticket. And I took off and went down to Baltimore. I took her car and I took her credit card because I didn't, my car was wrecked anyway. And I went down to Baltimore and I got to drinking. And on my way back, I was about a mile from the house and I hit this car. It had a man and his 10-year-old son in it. I flipped him over the embankment and I left him there. Everything inside of me says, "Joe, you got to go help him." I could hear him screaming. And I just left him there. You ever wonder by the time we get there, what are the noises that are going on in our head? It's my mother crying. It's my wife pleading with me. It's my kids crying. "Daddy, why do you keep doing this?" It's them voices of that man and his 10-year-old son. It's all of the things that I've done throughout my past, and I'm trying to drown it out with my drinking. And is what happened is I got sober back in 1989, and I was still married. And you know, I didn't get sober. I didn't come to AA to get sober and stay sober. I came here because I had a lot of problems. I had legal problems, financial problems, marital problems, job. I had a lot of problems. But in my mind, drinking wasn't one of those problems. And I came to AA and I figured if I could just kind of get all, you ever get your life and you take a look at it? Like when I totaled that car and I ended up, I came back to the house and I got in my truck and I took off again and I came back and the cops came there the next day to get me. And my little girls, they were like 4 and 6. And the cops are trying to put the handcuffs on me and I'm trying to tell them, "Why can't we take this outside?" And that's all I meant by that was I don't want my little girls to see me getting locked up. And they thought I wanted to fight. So, you know, and after all of that came back and I came in and we have the stack of fines and the total cars there. And, you know, I'm probably going to lose my job over this. And I don't know about you. At that point, I really wanted to do something about my drinking. And I made this lame attempt or sincere attempt to try to stop drinking. And I went back to AA. I got a half a sponsor. In case you don't know what a half a sponsor is, it's a name and a phone number. Because people like Jeff, they'll bother you in AA. They'll follow you around and ask you, "Do you have a sponsor yet?" And if you got a name and a number, what it does for me is it tells you, "Leave me alone." And I'm back in AA, and I'm going to about 4 or 5 meetings a week, and I kind of like AA. And I make this decision, and my wife starts to see some changes in me. And I tell her, I said, "Why don't we take a trip? Why don't we get away from here? Why don't we pack up the kids and go to Florida?" And she seemed excited about that. She thought that would really solve the problem if we just get away for a while. So we took off to Florida. I'm about 3 months sober again. And we're in Disney World with the wife and kids. And the kids, man, they're just having the best old time of their lives, riding the rides and playing the games. And There, the wife is. She's having a grand old time. She's spending all that money that I'm going to be needing for a lawyer in about 6 months. And then there's sober Joe. Joe hasn't had a drink for about 3 months again. And the only thing going through my mind at about 3 months sober in Disney World with my wife and kids is if that mouse or that duck come up to me one more time, I'm going to punch them right in their mouth. They're a lot like the people in AA. You know, they'll stand right at the front door and want to hug you and follow you around and hold your hand. It's just very, it's hard. And the only thing going through my mind is I see a sign that says Busch Gardens. And I know if I get over there for a little while, I can let go of all of my problems and enjoy life at last. To me, isn't that insane? The very thing that created every problem in my life, the only solution I have is to take another drink. To me, that's what alcoholism is. It's not about how much I drank or how long I drank or, you know, or where I drank. It's not about none of those things. It's about that I can't leave that much booze alone no matter what I try. No matter what scheme I come up with, no matter what plan, what it is that I figure out is going to keep me sober, nothing keeps me sober. And at the end of that, is what happened to me is I ended up in the psychiatric ward of shock trauma hospital because somewhere between that time and 1991, I tried to kill myself. I got tired of playing the game. Maybe you're like me and you've been coming around AA for a little while and really haven't seemed to get any of the benefits. You'd come here and it seems like other people are getting better and they're getting happy and their lives are getting better. And, you know, and for me, when I get about 3 months sober, I can't stand it much longer than that. And I think is what alcoholism is I will stay sober as long as I can stand it. And then I have to drink to preserve whatever bit of sanity I got. To me, I can't speak for anybody else. One of the reasons I picked Tom to be my first sponsor, and he was my sponsor up to the day he passed away, the very first time I ever heard him talk, he stood at a podium. He spoke for 1 hour. I heard nothing but one thing. He stood up at the podium and he said, "It seems to me that alcohol actually allowed me to postpone suicide long enough to get here." And other people weren't talking to me like that. Other people were telling me, "Joe, drinking is what's creating your problems. Drinking created a lot of problems in my life, don't get me wrong. But drinking wasn't the problem. Is what the problem was is I can only stay sober as long as I can stand it. There's something wrong in here. Long before I ever took my first drink, there was something wrong in here. And drinking worked for the longest time. Women worked for a while. Money worked for a while. A lot of other things. I did a lot of, you know, things that, you know, because we're in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't talk about those things from the podium, that's all. You know, I'll tell you, when I was a kid, I was 10 years old, and my parents, like I said, had racehorses too, and we had this horse that went lame on Friday and was supposed to race on Saturday, and my stepfather gave him a shot of this stuff, and I mean, he ran the race, he won the race, and he ran so fast that he broke his leg. I remember being 10 years old thinking, man, I would like to get a hold of some of that. You know? So I had this fetish for other things. I've always had a fetish for those kind of things. But drinking is what killed me. And I'm laying in this psychiatric ward. My nose is gone. My legs are all busted up. I fought with the paramedics because they were trying to cut me out of the truck. I told them, just leave me the hell alone. There was a 100-pound bottle of oxygen and a 100-pound bottle of acetylene strapped in the back and it came into the cab. In my mind, I shouldn't be here. And I'm laying in this psychiatric ward. I'm strapped down. And my little girls, they were 5 and 7. They came into the hospital with she was still my wife at the time. And they came up to my bedside and they says, "Daddy, can't you promise that you won't do this anymore?" And as much as I wanted to make that promise, I knew I couldn't. And much, much more importantly, if ever I needed a drink, it was at that moment. That's why I drank. In the beginning, I drank because it was lots of fun and lots of good times and parties and all the other things. And in the end, like the book was talking about, just trying to blot out of my mind all of the things that I've done. You know, I'm going to go forwards real quick for a second. I got to my A step list with my sponsor, and we went over my A step list. And he says, "Where is your mother at on this list?" And I said, "Tom, I never did anything to her." He said, "You told me about the time she was having you locked up." And I said, "Yeah, do you remember that? She was having me locked up. She was over there snitching me out to the cops because I was stealing from her, right? And the cops were kind of putting the handcuffs on me, and I can see her over there, and I'm begging her, "Mom, why are you doing this to me? I'm your son, for God's sakes." And she kind of put her head down a little bit, and I was drunk, about half drunk at that time. So I laid into her. I said, "You effing blankety blank, it's your fault my life's so screwed up. I hate your blanking guts. I wish I was never born." And she began to cry, and she walked away. And he says, "Joe, you told me that story." And I said, "Well, yeah, I can understand it." Now, he says, "Let's just go out on a limb. Maybe is what you do to people is you push them and you push them and you push them until they have no other choice, but they either lock you up, put you away, do something with you, get him out of here, and then you blame them for the way your life has turned out." And up until this time, that's all I've ever done. My first treatment center, I was a victim. I mean, that's what I thought they wanted to hear. I told them how my mother used to get beat unconscious by my stepfather, and I told them every story. Guns in the house. My mother would call me, "Joe, you got to come over. They're going to kill each other." I'm talking about my brother and my stepfather. And I would tell them all these stories. I told them the story about when I was 10 years old, thinking to myself, "I can't wait till my stepfather dies because I want to be right next to his bed so I can put my hand over his mouth and take his last breath." That's a lot of hatred as a 10-year-old kid. And I would share all of those things. And I was told in this treatment center I was most likely to succeed in AA because I was so honest. And I'm here to tell you I was not honest with those people. I told them everything about everybody else. I never got honest with me about me. When I was laying in that psychiatric ward, when I tried to kill myself, that's when the truth came. They shouldn't call it suicide. It should be called murder, as my sponsor put it, because we're killing somebody. We have absolutely no idea who that person is. I believe that once I finally seen the truth about me, I could no longer live with myself. At the end of my drinking, when I'm laying in that psychiatric ward, I'm a failure. I'm a complete failure as a father, as a son, as a husband, as a brother, as a human being, just a complete failure in every area of my life, and I can't live with me. And I think that that's the perfect time to come to AA. You know, I'd like to say that I came right to Alcoholics Anonymous when I left that place. You know, it's kind of crazy that as much as I wanted to be honest with those people, I couldn't tell them the truth. Is all I wanted to tell my counselors or the psychiatrists who were trying to help, is all I wanted to say to them, "One, I don't know what's wrong with me. Will you please help me?" But I couldn't get those words out of my mouth. I kept falling back into all the things that people were doing to me and how my life sort of screwed up and how I've got a bad deal in life and, you know, it's just not fair and, you know, just depressed all the time. And you know what? When I left that place, you know what they... Usually when I would leave a place like that, they would say, "You need some follow-up care, you need some counseling, you need to go to AA." They would say something. On my discharge papers is what they wrote was, "Good luck." Good luck, because you're going to need it. The book talks about people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest. I'm not one of those people. AA has enabled me to get honest. I don't know how you guys work, but if I'm put in a corner, I'm going to lie. It's like when you go into a courtroom and the judge says, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God." I'm thinking you could have stopped at the first truth. You didn't have to go on with the other two. Because as soon as I feel the pressure, I'm going to start lying. My theory in life was if you don't want me to lie to you, just don't ask me any questions, right? We've probably got a good shot of breaking even. But AA is what AA does, at least for me, is I could sit in a meeting and I could listen to somebody share and I could get a little bit more honest each day about who I am. Okay? What I found is what it takes to get sober is I thought we're going to come to AA, we're going to make one big surrender and that's all it's going to take. We're going to get sober. We're going to stay sober for the rest of our lives. Ha-ha times, good times, fun, everything like that. And what I found is this business of honesty is about, it's different. You know, a good friend of mine would say to me, "Joe, do you believe half that shit you say?" And I think, I don't know, just give me about 6 months. I might not believe any of this stuff anymore. I might believe something else. And I found out that's called growth. You know, and what happened is I got to this place where, like I said, I had no other choice but to ask this man for help. And I was given a man's name in a courtroom, and I was told in this courtroom, if you ask this man to be your sponsor, your life won't have to be this way anymore. And I'm thinking, I mean, you look at any newcomer's life when we come in. If you look at me and I put all of my problems on the table, I'm being divorced, I can't see my kids, I'm being sued, I don't have a license, don't have a job, don't have a car. And you're telling me if I do these two simple things, my life won't have to be that way anymore. And you see, I can't comprehend that in the beginning. But if you get desperate enough, is what I found, if you get desperate enough, you'll do things that you don't believe will work. You'll do things that you don't understand. Just like simply asking another man for help. And when I asked that man for help, I'm here to tell you that something happened. Something changed inside of me. I became willing to do whatever it takes to get sober and stay sober. And you know, that hasn't left me. July 26, 1991 is not the date of my last drink. It's the day that I asked that man to be my sponsor. And my sponsor had different ideas than I had. I got newcomer ideas when I come into AA. Newcomer ideas like, if that's my ex-wife, I'm not here. Newcomer ideas like, if easy does it, right? Sponsors get up to steps 4 and 5, and we kind of want to slow them down at that point. My sponsor wanted to get me through the steps before I left, and he would constantly say that to me. He says, Joe, we're going to do the steps before you leave, because you're leaving. He would talk to me like I was leaving. And if you think about it, alcoholism, in my mind, is happening right here, right now. A lot of us are leaving, and we don't even know that we're leaving. We're planning on staying. We want to stay. But the truth of the matter is that if I got the alcoholic mind, and it's going to be picking things apart. Let's say Mark shared last week at the meeting, and he comes up to another meeting this week, and, oh, geez, it's going to be Mark again, and we begin to get closed-minded. We can't listen. You know, and my mind, I'm looking for reasons to leave AA. You know, I'm thinking, man, if I could just get my marriage back together and my kids and my job and get all of those things together, I'm going to be all right. And I'm here to tell you that about 3 months sober, my life came completely unraveled. Everything that I was working for and trying to get completely fell apart. Divorce papers came. If you get a permanent address for about 3 months and they find out where you're at, your past catches up, right? And I'm about 3 months sober and the divorce papers are coming, the lawsuit papers are coming. I'm being sued for about $40,000+. I can't see my kids. I don't have a job. I'm living in the back of my mother's house in a 10x10 room because that's all I can do at this time. And my sponsor had me up to steps 8 and 9 at that point, at about 3 months sober. And at about 3 months sober, with everything that was happening, for the first time, I knew I was going to be all right. I'm praying to a God that I really don't believe in. I'm taking actions that I really don't understand. The 12 steps don't make any sense to me when I get sober. And I'm at the 8th step. And one of the first amends I had to make was to my stepfather. My sponsor said to me, he says, Joe, what amend don't you want to make? And I said, my stepfather. You know, and he says, well, that's a good one to start with. And I don't know how. I had about $10,000 worth of jewelry that I had stolen from him. If I would have found it before I got sober, I'd probably be dead, but I couldn't find it. And he says, well, you need to give that back to him. And I said, it's mine. And I really believe that it was mine. My theory, my way of thinking was, if I work for you and you don't pay me accordingly what I think I deserve, I do what is called is compensating myself. And sponsors, they call that stealing, right? And my sponsor says, you're going to give that back. And I said, well, it's mine. He said, if you want to stay sober, you're going to give that back. And I had a little bit of a dilemma here because I really didn't want to give it back. But nevertheless, I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to get drunk. So I began to make that amend. I made the approach to my stepfather and I said, Donald, I said, one of the things I got to do to stay sober is I got to make amends to the people I've harmed. And one of the ways I harmed you is I stole from you and I gave them the jewelry back. And I said, just, you know, not even believing what I was saying, that if there's anything I can do to make this right, please let me know. And nothing big happened at that moment. About 3 months later, he was going into the hospital for open heart surgery. And my sponsor says, Joe, you need to go see him. And I didn't think one way or the other about it. You know, I didn't hate him. I didn't care. It didn't matter. But I went to go visit him at the hospital because my sponsor told me to. And I went up to see him. And we were sitting there talking maybe about 10 or 15 minutes. And before I left there, something moved me to walk over to him, and I put my arms around him, and I hugged him, and I told him I'd been praying for him, and that I loved him a great deal. And all of that hatred was gone. And I'm here to tell you that hatred has never returned. And much, much more importantly, about maybe 3 or 4 months later, he died. And I was at his bedside praying with him. And I was his stepson. He has two other sons and three other daughters. And one of the things he said to me at that time, he says, out of all of my kids, you're the only one I respect. My other brothers and sisters would have spit on him. They couldn't stand him. And we're sitting there praying. And here's what I learned at this pretty early in sobriety. I want to be forgiven. I don't know what you've done in life. I've hurt everybody that I came in contact with. Anybody who cared about me, I hurt. And I hurt people in such a way I would never share from the podium. Okay? And I want to be forgiven. But yet I don't want to forgive. I mean, I needed to really take a look at that. And when we're sitting there talking, I could see the fear, and I understood. Here's what I understood. I understood I don't want to leave this earth knowing that I didn't have a chance to try to at least make it right. And my stepfather, he never had that opportunity. And when I did my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, when I got done, he put his arms around me and he hugged me and he said, "Welcome to the human race, you're one of God's kids." And I didn't understand the importance of that until that day when my stepfather was dying. And I put my arms around him and I hugged him and I told him he was one of God's kids and that I loved him a great deal, and so does God. And you know, when he died, when he finally took his last breath, I didn't want to reach over and take it from him. I had empathy for him. I can only imagine what it's like to leave this earth with unfinished business. My sponsor knew. I didn't know. I understand it today. My sponsor knew. This isn't about making right what's in front of us. It's about getting the past right. If I want to be free, that's how we get free. We clean up the past. Freedom isn't like, you know, avoiding it or getting a big house or getting remarried or getting my own business. You know, even though I got remarried in AA, got started a new business, so, you know, all kinds of good things, bought a new house, all kinds of good stuff that can happen. Freedom was about cleaning up the past. I remember one of the first attempts I tried getting sober, and I called my first half a sponsor, and I called him up. I got out of, it was Carroll County Detention Center down in Maryland, and I called him up after I got out, and I says, "John, you're not, I'm free, right?" I wanted him to come pick me up because I didn't have a ride. And he let me know that AA is not a taxi cab service. And but he didn't say that at the time. He says, "Son, you're not free. You're loose." And he hung up on me. There is a big difference between being free and being loose. He says, because you're going to get caught again. And he was telling the truth. Good AAs can see right through our stuff. You know, my sponsor could see right through my stuff. I don't know if you've ever lied to your sponsor. I've lied to my sponsor on numerous occasions. I remember lying to him once. I had a date, and I was supposed to go to a meeting with him, and I had a date, and she stood me up. And I thought, Jesus, you know, my friend Mike, this guy and I, we got sober together, my hero, one of my heroes in AA. And Mike sat in the back seat, and he knew. I'd tell Mike the whole truth about everything, but I couldn't tell my sponsor those kind of things. And Mike would keep kicking the seat like, "Joe, you're going to tell him. You're going to tell on yourself." And I told him, I said, "Tom, I was supposed to go to the meeting with you last week, and I had a date, and she stood me up." He says, "Well, God damn, that's just a damn shame, isn't it?" You know, like it was no big deal. And I carry that stuff around. You know, AA is about, you know, it's about being free, and it's about letting go every day. Every day we got to surrender. It's not about making. My sponsor used to say it to me all the time. He says, "Joe," he says, you really think you're smart." And I thought he recognized me. And he says, "You really think you're smart." I says, "Yes, sometimes I do, Tom." He says, "You remind me of the guy who thinks he can take one big breath and make it last all day." He said, surrendering's a lot like that. If you don't learn how to surrender on a regular basis, you're going to have a hard time in AA. You hear some of my friends say it all the time. You know, everything I let go of had claw marks on it. That's not my experience. Everything I let go of, freedom followed closely behind. Everything I held on to brought pain and misery. You know, You hear all kinds of things in AA. I'm not here to criticize or put down anybody. If you believe what it goes against what I'm saying, that's fine. You know, there was a time that I believed certain things still. I used to run around AA all the time, just saying stuff that made absolute. I was sharing in a meeting one night. My sponsor was sitting right up front. I thought I was impressing him, you know. And I was only about 10, 15 minutes into my talk, and he said, "Son," right in the middle of the meeting, he said, "When this meeting's over, I want to have a talk with you." Well, I'm here to tell you the meeting was over at that moment. I wasn't done talking yet. And he pulled me aside after the meeting was over. He says, "Joe, where did you get that idea?" And I didn't know which one he was talking about, right? You don't want to give the wrong one away. And he says, "That idea of take what you want and leave the rest." And I said, "Well, that's what, you know, Jeff was sharing last week at the meeting, blame it on somebody real quick, you know." And he said, "Maybe, just go out on a limb with me, Joe. Maybe it's what you've done your whole life, is you've taken what you want and left the rest. Maybe that's exactly how you got to AA, by always taking what you want and leaving the rest. Why can't you just follow simple directions the way they're laid out? When it says we're going to, in the first step, that we're going to surrender, that we're going to concede, right? Conceding and surrendering is not about, you know, it's not about admitting that I'm an alcoholic. It's about swallowing something. That something's broken here. And then when it says we're going to come to believe, maybe it's saying that because you don't really believe right now. But you got to make that decision what you're going to do. And, you know, in the third step, it was only a decision to try to really go forward. You know, I used to think the third step that you had to really just get down on your knees and pray and do it right. Maybe join a church. And if you're going to church, that's fine. I'm not here to criticize. Maybe I told my sponsor, "I got to go to 12 years of Catholic school before I can do the third step." And he just laughed at me. And the third step for me is nothing but 4 through 9. That's how I still turn my will over. That's how I still turn it over. That doesn't change. But the thing that does change is the pain doesn't have to get as great as it used to be before I can surrender. You know, I don't know. I'm talking to a few guys tonight, and we have problems that happen after we get sober. We have difficulties. Nobody says that, you know, everything's going to be perfect after we get sober, and I hope that you don't believe that it is. Life is life. You know, it rains on me just like it rains on you. It's not going to treat me any differently. You know, my mother recently just passed away. I got it right with her before she passed away. She got to live with us for about the last 4.5 years of her life. You know, and it's really, some things are a little bit more difficult than others. You know, she's laying there, and some things that we have to do. Out of all of my brothers, I was given the power, you know, to turn the machine off. And that was her last wish to me. And everybody would treat me like, "What's wrong with you? Why are you doing this?" If that's her last wish, that's her last wish. If she doesn't want to live this way, there's nothing I can do about that. You know, one of the things that happened in sobriety is that a lot of good things happened too, don't get me wrong. My little 14-year-old nephew was trying to commit suicide. And I had to take my brother to court and take his son from him. And we're sitting in the courtroom. It was a big switch for me. You know, I'm on the other side of the counter, you know, and the judge is sitting there, and my brother's on the other side with his attorney. And my brother looks at me and says, "For God's sakes, why are you doing this to me? I'm your brother, for God's sakes." And here's what came out of my mouth, and this is AA. "How can you push me to such a point that I got to take such actions as to take your son from you?" I couldn't see that when I was doing that to everybody in my life. And it's only until I get to AA that I can see the truth. You know, we had said the set-aside prayer. And at the end, it's, you know, "Please help me to see the truth." If I would have gotten all the truth when I first got sober, I would have killed myself. That's just simply a fact. If I would have known how sick I really was when I walked through the doors of AA, I would have just ended it right at that moment. And I don't mean that in a negative way. Is what I mean is that I didn't realize how strong alcoholism. How many of us in this room have had friends who leave here and they got everything to live for because they just can't seem to get this? And what do we say to them? "Well, I guess they didn't want it." I think that's horseshit. I think everybody that comes here and gets sober, I don't think that they say, "I don't want AA. I don't want, you know, what AA has to offer." I think that somewhere along the line they just fell short. You know, and not everybody that leaves Alcoholics Anonymous can make it back. You know, I have no idea how many people we've buried in York, Pennsylvania within the last 6 months to a year. People we get close to. And you want to help. And something I've learned more than anything else in the world is I can't want this more for somebody than they want it for themselves. Because it brings me a lot of hardship. You know, when I'm trying to help somebody in AA, I think the most important thing we do here in AA is to try to pass this on to one alcoholic from another. You know, we don't do it trying to be big shots or nothing like that. We do it because our lives depend on it. But I worked with a lot of people, and you know, they, for some reason, some people just, I mean, I've gotten real close. I got friends that are real close to right now are just out there struggling. And I think, what is the difference between them and I? It's not that I'm smarter than them. It's not that I've read something that separates me from them. I know that I'm not smarter than them. They probably got more brains in their pinky than I got in my whole brain. It's because one simple thing to me, in all this time that I've been sober, not once have I thought to myself, God, you're doing a piss poor job with my life. I think I'll take it from here. I don't want to be in charge. Being in charge creates nothing but problems for me. I don't want to be in charge of me. I don't want to be in charge of my wife. I don't want to be in charge of my kids. I'm not in charge of my business. I just show up every day and do my small part. Being in charge is not a good thing. You know, if you want to be, my sponsor says, do you want to be happy or you want to be in charge? You know, it's real simple. And, you know, since I got sober, I got remarried in AA, married an AA girl, typical AA relationship. The only reason this one worked is because I waited. You know what I mean? And I talked to her, waited till she had a year and a half, 2 years sober. That's a good idea, right? I knew her sponsor. Her sponsor, we're sitting there, we're riding down the road, and her sponsor says to her, well, I guess you can start dating now. And I thought, oh, my ears perked up again, you know, just like Swapping Wives did, you know, not no saint here. And then her sponsor says, but for God's sakes, don't sleep with them. And I thought, Jesus, God, her sponsor and I are really good friends. And I think she kind of knew something was going on. And, you know, between my wife and I, we got 18 grandkids. I think we started having kids when we were about 12, you know, because 18 grandkids. Do you know our kids actually want to be part of our lives? More so hers than mine. I created a lot of problems growing up. I got two daughters, and one of them even after all this time, doesn't want to really have anything to do with me. We can create problems. We can hurt people to a point where it takes a long time for that recovery to begin. And the reason I'm telling you this is because I've met a lot of people in AA who think that that's what's supposed to happen when we get sober. All of our lives and loved ones are supposed to come back into our life. And it doesn't always work out that way. But the good news is you can stay sober and happy and enjoy life in spite of all of that thing. Because here's what I've learned. Okay, in order for me to be free, I had to make amends to the people that I've harmed and the people I had resentments to. And I think that principle applies across the board. I can only clean off my side of the street. I can't clean off anybody else's side of the street. This business of forgiveness is all the way around. If she wants to be forgiven, or if she wants to have freedom, she's going to have to forgive me somewhere along the line. I'm not saying that to be smart. I'm saying that because I know beyond anything is that I can't make somebody forgive me. That's something they have to do. You know, real quickly, if I could share anything with anybody in this room tonight, I think, you know, we don't always have a lot of time in AA. I think we have 1 hour maybe to carry a message to somebody who might be leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I could share anything with you, is I beg of you to just try to do these things with even whether you have an understanding or not. There's nothing to really understand here. My sponsor said would always tell me experience doesn't come, and AA, the steps and all, doesn't come from knowing things as you're going into it. It comes as a result of doing it. Just like taking the actions, you know, turning my will and my life over to the care of God, it doesn't look like the right idea. But it's never, ever failed in all of this time that I've been sober. Never. And I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to come out here and share with you tonight, and I'll turn the meeting back over.